Good morning and welcome to the December 16th, 2024 edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a chilly morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning.
We got some fun stuff coming up today, Kevin. We're going to start with a chat with about the tax implications of year-end giving with tax attorneys Matt Mitten and Ross Keough of Parsons Bailey.
And then we'll chat with Sarah Vieira and Ben Kubicki of Real Brokerage. And we'll finish our hour by speaking with Sam Protopapas and Julie Sieving of the Intermountain Industrial Assessment Center at the University of Utah. Whoa!
We'll then have a bonus chat with Juliana Alali and Sarah Irvin of KPCW. All this and more on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. We're joined in the studio by Sarah Vieira and Ben Kubicki of Real Broker. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Can you guys share a bit about your backgrounds and what led you to real estate, Ben?
So I am originally from Ohio and moved here about 7 years ago. Sarah, she grew up here, actually, and went to school. But we got into real estate due to my mom. She was an agent and sold back in Ohio when we were young kids. She was in real estate for about 20 years. And really, we just kind of grew up around it. And she guided us, and we got started with her. She was actually part of our team when I first started and when Sarah first started. And we had a great mentor from her. And she's retired now, but we still use her and rely on her for many things, and because she just has that experience. She has a lot of sales under her belt and is really good with people and just has a lot of knowledge that we have come to rely on. And so it's nice having her in our back pocket.
Nice. And Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, my mom originally really is the reason we got into this. We grew up with it, saw it our whole lives, really. We watched her do this growing up. So number one, she kind of pulled me into this. Back in 2017, got my license then, and then her and I partnered up and worked together, and then Ben came in about a year later, I'd say. And so I think, you know, I just, again, watching her and what she was able to do with her career and as a mother attracted me to the market and or to the industry initially. And then just she, like Ben said, she was our mentor really for the first few years. And then we kind of retired her to grandma, but she's still in the background guiding us and mentoring us. So, that's initially why we got in.
Yeah. So Real Broker is very different from your traditional real estate firm. Can you highlight some of the main differences?
I think Real Brokerage, it is a little bit different than the traditional brokerage model, but really only for agents. It's not any different for clients. Mm-hmm. I mean, they still get the same white glove service that they're given with any other brokerage in town, like Christie's, Sotheby's. The only difference is really for the agents and the way that we have different streams of income. I would say we have the traditional commission, but then they also offer what's called rev share. We have stock options and all of that. A lot more commission opportunities for us than the traditional brokerage. But as far as for our clients, there is really no difference of what we're offering in terms of service. It's the exact, we operate the same, our operations are the same from the previous brokerage we were with to Real. I do think on the back end of technology and stuff, we have some more offerings for our clients. But yeah, I think there's a little bit of a misconception as far as us being this different, it's technically called a cloud brokerage. But really, our offerings are the exact same for our clients. And a cloud brokerage, all that means is that we're really operating online, and we don't have a traditional office, brick and mortar. But again, that doesn't change what our services are for our clients. We're actually able to save money, and so we don't have to pay for this brick and mortar office that a lot of agents these days aren't using. I mean, if you would ask a traditional brokerage how many of their agents are actually using the office, it's a very low number. And so we're able to save some costs there to put back into our marketing, put back into our clients, and give them actually a greater service. So,
nice. Yeah, I've bought a few places. I don't think I've ever walked into a real estate office.
Yeah. I mean, a huge proportion of clients never actually see the inside of a brokerage office. So, you know, I understand there is benefits to having a brick and mortar office, maybe for some agents. But for us, that wasn't really an attraction point in what we needed. And so we were paying for a service with our brokerage that we weren't utilizing.
And when you think about some of the traditional brokerages, particularly the large ones, there's a whole series of back office and support, marketing teams, legal, et cetera. Does Real have all of that, just not in a single brick and mortar kind of facility?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, none of that. We have all the same foundational aspects that any traditional brokerage has. All of that still is with Real. There, like I said, there really is no difference for our clients with this brokerage. In that sense, we are still a traditional brokerage. We have all of that support. We have all that back end mortgage, title, transaction coordinators, brokers, all of that remains traditional. I think COVID, if anything, changed everybody, you know, agents alike didn't go into the office. And so it kind of opened up that opportunity to work. Agents were working more from home, and now we realize we don't need that brick and mortar office. Agents still are just working from home or homes where they're selling, they're actually working out of their listings. And so, I think the office, the in-person office is not needed as much today in 2024 as it maybe once was. And we're collaborating on Zooms, we're collaborating on even just FaceTimes. I mean, there's so many different apps available these days for everyone to collaborate still, where we don't need to be in person, and with how busy life is for everybody and you're running from listing to listing. I mean, you can work from anywhere now with the technology that is available to us in 2024. And so I just don't think that brick and mortar office is needed and utilized like it once was back in the day when we didn't have this technology available.
Absolutely. I mean, Zoom is fantastic. It allows you to get back on the mountain quicker.
Yeah.
No, for sure. And with Real, they have weekly trainings. There's every day there are multiple trainings over Zoom, over video conference, and those are recorded as well. So that's if you want to go and play those back. I mean, it's all there. It's all available. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because there's no office doesn't mean that there is no training or anything like that. There is so much training. It's mind-boggling.
I think you alluded to some different other technology innovations that Real is using. Can you share a little bit about what you were thinking about?
So they have what is called Real Reason, and it's a technology platform. And Real really was a technology company to begin with. And so everything is on their app, Reason app, and you can run all of your documents. You can get your documents signed through that. You run the whole transaction through that, and it's really just seamless. It is, quite honestly, so easy. When I first started using it, I couldn't believe it. It was awesome because everything is right there. And it works, it's fast, it's efficient. I mean, you can get documents set up and signed in 30 seconds. I mean, really, once you get efficient with it, you can absolutely do it in 30, 40 seconds. Get it signed, get it on your phone, and run it right to whoever you need to an agent, to a client, whoever you need. And it's all from your phone.
They're actually also utilizing AI. So on mm-hmm. the app, they have an AI tool. It's called Leo. And I know this might sound silly, but it really is super efficient, because if you have any question, instead of you researching, trying to find the answer to your question, I mean, you just type it in. It's AI, and it provides the answer to you or leads you to the link that you need to get to.
And is this proprietary AI that you guys wrote, that you had written for you?
This is from Real Brokerage. Okay. Yes, this is specifically on their app called Reason, which is how us agents operate. And so if I have any question as an agent that I need an answer to like that, it comes to me in, you know, 3 seconds. And so instead of me having to take 10 minutes to dig through and search through our technology, I mean, it brings it right to me.
Yeah, the so-called knowledge base that...
Essential, yep.
Yeah. After many years, it's pretty big. So yep. That's cool. The AI goes right into that and finds it for you.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just really tech forward. I think, you know, obviously, I'm sure a lot of agents are using things like ChatGPT and stuff, but to have this at our fingertips from our brokerage to provide us all the answers that we might have, especially as newer agents, when new agents get brought onto this brokerage and you're learning, I mean, it's a whole nother platform you're learning, right, as a new agent to this brokerage. And so it's just got all the information right there. I mean, just it's like a Google search.
So. Nice. So let's look at the elephant in the room, in the real estate room, if you will. What impact has the settlement of the NAR litigation had as a practical matter in this market?
I think, I mean, that's obviously changed things. I don't think that it's changed things too drastically. Now, there's just more negotiations. There's always been negotiations. Commissions have always been negotiable. It's just kind of brought it to the forefront right away. And there's more negotiations up front with other agents. We're getting more calls and talking about that first, when normally it was just advertised on the MLS, so we didn't have to have that conversation. Now it's just more conversations, and I don't know.
I think, you know, the commissions have always kind of been the elephant in the room, actually, and it's something that no one's ever really wanted to discuss. I feel like our industry actually has probably done not a great job, and it's why we are where we are with this. And so it's just, it's brought the commissions to the forefront. We should have had these conversations all along. Commissions have always technically been negotiable. They always have been. It's just that we, as agents, maybe haven't done the best job of talking about it up front. And so maybe some clients have felt a little in the dark of it and didn't realize that it was a negotiation. And so now we're just having those open conversations, and it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be the elephant in the room that it maybe once was. And so it's just been brought to light, the commission conversation. But in the, you know, in the technical terms of it with other agents, yes, we do have to talk about it up front because it's not advertised on the MLS. So when you're talking with an agent or going in for a showing, you need to know up front what your commission could be. And everyone's tackling this a little bit different, and we're still working this out. I mean, I think every transaction is different. Every agent is operating differently. Every client is operating different. This is all so new to us that there really isn't a standard right now of how this is being dealt with. Every agent is handling it differently.
Gotcha. So now continuing on with that, do you think you've spent less, you know, since it went into effect, what, July? Do you think you've spent less time in the car driving, looking at places that they really, maybe a client can't afford or has no interest in?
No, I mean, I don't think it honestly hasn't changed our day-to-day operations at all. I think, you know, we just go into with a client, a showing, knowing that we're going to either have to negotiate our commission with the client or negotiate our commission with the seller. I think this is still, it really is still falling. The commission is still being paid. Well, it's negotiated in the REPSI. So now, this is a key point in the real estate purchase contract where it wasn't before. It's actually a listing. Sorry, let me think. The listing agreement specifically called out the buyer broker compensation before, but now the real estate purchase contract specifically calls out the commission.
So a new document.
So it's not a new document. It's a new paragraph in the document.
Oh, good.
That's all it is. So it's calling it out specifically between the seller and the buyer, whereas before it was an agreement between the listing and the buyer broker.
I want to touch on current market conditions. What are you seeing in the various segments of the Summit Wasatch market, and what do you expect in 2025?
So right now, active listings in Park City and in the Heber Valley and surrounding areas are down. Active listings are down, but sales are still going up. From last year, which is mind-boggling. So things are still selling, but there's just lower inventory. I think this area is desired. People want to be here, so people are always going to come here. And, I mean, we live here, and it's beautiful. We know what it's like. So I think right now, next year, I think it's going to be great, honestly. We have the new Deer Valley East, which opened up a whole new resort, whole new area. People want to be around the Jordanelle. People want to be in Deer Valley East. It's a hot new thing. So people are going to continue to come here, especially as more areas around the Jordanelle get developed. So I think 2025 is going to be great. I think it's going to be awesome.
Now, do you think it's that maybe those who've lived here for a while aren't switching houses because they have 2.75 mortgage and they don't want to give that up?
Yeah, I definitely think that's part of it. I think people have good rates that have been here for a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they've been here a long time, they've got a lot of equity in their homes. And if they just do a lateral move, you know, they're going to have to pay the same for what they sold their house. So why not just stay where you are? And, yeah, I think they have those rates and they want to stick to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a factor for a long time to come. I mean, those people are going to potentially stay on their properties forever.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to impact the market for a long time. But what I do want to touch on, what I think is interesting right now, is the high-end market is crushing right now. I mean, they are selling. It's it's wild. Like what we see, what's called our hot sheet on the MLS, it shows us what's new, pending, closed, and, you know, depending on how you set your settings in the last few days. And it is absolutely wild to see the high-end market is crushing right now. So that market, I'd say, has an uptick in sales.
Outstanding. Yeah. Now, how can people learn more about your operation, what you do, and, I mean, is there a website?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So our brand is Selling Park City, mm-hmm. so you can find us at sellingparkcity.com. Our Instagram handle is Selling Park City. Ben and I both operate on that, and you can find us at those two locations, Instagram and sellingparkcity.com.
So we just spent a few minutes with Sarah and Ben from Real Broker. Thank you very much. Enjoy your day.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you for having us over.
As we approach year-end, many of us consider year-end charitable donations. And while donations to IRS-registered charities are considered tax-deductible, what does that really mean in today's environment, given the current standard deduction level? Here to talk about that and some interesting strategies to maximize potential tax savings are attorneys Matt Mitten and Ross Keough of Parsons Bailey. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
Oh, we have both of you. Excellent. Computers are working. Well, hey, let's start with the basics, if that's okay. What does the term tax deductible actually mean? How about Ross?
Yeah, so and thank you again for having us on here. It's our pleasure. The way the deduction works is if you make a qualifying gift to a charity, those are all terms of art in the Internal Revenue Code, but typically we're talking about a organization that has been recognized by the IRS as a 501c3. You're able to take and reduce your taxable income by that amount, subject to the deduction limits that each individual may have, and also for the total amount of your income that you can reduce by making so-called qualified gifts.
Okay, breaking that down just a little bit. You know, historically, people always think, oh, it's tax deductible, and therefore I'm getting a break. And I guess the first concept is you get a break to the extent that it reduces your taxable income and therefore impacts by the percentage of your marginal rate what you're going to have to pay the government. Is that basically right?
That's exactly correct.
Yep. Okay. So we start with that. And, you know, up until a couple of years ago, lots of people were able to itemize deductions. But then the current the standard deduction got raised to a high level. Can you explain how all that works together?
Absolutely. So what happened in 2017 is what you might call Trump 1.0. A piece of legislation called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed, which attempted to do a number of things, one of which was to simplify the tax code. And as a result of that simplification, the mechanics of that deduction, the standard deduction, were fundamentally changed. And the standard deduction was increased. It's now inflation adjusted, $29,200 for a married couple for the 2024 tax year, or $14,600 for an individual. And so everyone gets that. So in order for a charitable contribution to make a, as you said, marginal difference on your tax return, your remaining itemized deductions plus that charitable amount have to exceed that standard deduction amount. And what made that very hard for most individuals to get above is we lost a number of very common standard deductions, but we also lost we had a cap put in place on real property taxes that were previously exempt and other state and local taxes called the SALT cap. And for a married couple, it capped that deduction at $10,000. And so most people on their return would only have that as an itemized deduction available to them, and then are trying to find another, in this case, $18,200 before their charitable contribution will make a marginal difference to their taxable income.
So as a practical matter, I think, and you may know this, the number of people, the percentage of people that can actually itemize above that standard deduction is probably pretty small and probably largely limited to people who have large mortgages.
Yeah. I mean, the mortgage interest deduction is not something that's in play. So you're really limited unless you have enough mortgage interest to get right. to get over that threshold.
Okay. This is all coming from the 2017 bill. And one of the things that was done in 2017 was that a number of the provisions of that bill were scheduled to, quote, sunset, end quote, next year. Would the standard deduction be one of those things? Would that be something that would boomerang back to the low level it was previously? And what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, excellent point. So Trump 2.0, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act expires at the end of 2025. There are a number of provisions in that bill that are set to sunset unless they are extended under the legislation. I think it's important to know which provisions are on the table and which aren't. Happy to provide a quick overview of that. Mm-hmm. The first one that does not change, that I think a lot of taxpayers should be sensitive to, is the current C-Corp tax rate of 21%. So that's locked regardless of whether or not Congress acts to extend the bill. The other one that does sunset is the SALT cap, the $10,000 SALT cap, and the enhanced standard deduction, and we would get all of the itemized deductions back. So it's basically for the individual a reset to Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, kind of back to 2017 tax principles. There's another provision, which I think Matt can talk about more, that's going to be very critical, and that is the estate tax exclusion. Right now, that exclusion has been doubled, but that will reset and halve at the end of 2025, absent congressional action.
So I want you guys to, it's the end of the year, and it's always fun to get out your crystal ball. I know looking at the journal this morning and over the weekend, there's lots of speculation about what might happen. You guys think about this a lot. Give us your best crystal ball guesses as to, you know, what the fight's going to be in Congress this year over these issues and what's likely to happen.
Yeah, so I might sort of draw a contrast to what happened in 2017. And I think that's probably a reasonable place to start if we think about how stuff may play out in 2025. The first data point we have is that the Republican Party has indicated that this is not priority number one. This is maybe priority number two or priority number three. And they see a large tax package playing out in Q3, Q4. So if we go back to 2017, when the prior tax package passed, I mean, we didn't really see a version of that bill until very late November, and it didn't fundamentally become law until sometime, you know, mid-December. So at a minimum, I think we should all anticipate that we're not going to know much until very late in 2025. The second observation that I would have is that the Republicans had much stronger majorities, more Republican votes perhaps than they do now, by a pretty significant amount. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, when it passed the House of Republicans or the House of Representatives, it did so with 10 or 11 Republicans voting against that bill in 2017. The Republicans only have three votes to control their majority in the current Congress. And so they can not afford to lose really more than one, maybe two Republican votes. And so they're looking for a piece of legislation that A is extremely costly. I mean, preliminary estimates of just extending the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act put it at around the $4 trillion price tag. And so if you have budget sensitive Republicans, you, I think, have a very, very challenging legislative posture to get us to an extension. So where does that leave us with a prediction? I mean, there's certainly some interest in extending some of the key provisions of the bill. I think it's really going to depend on how budget sensitive the Republican Congress is and how much they're willing to add to the deficit about what all gets added in there. And I think there's a very real probability that the Republicans don't get a tax package through by the end of 2024. And these provisions sunset, including the federal estate tax exclusion.
And I wanted to get to that. Yes, go ahead.
Matt probably has a lot to offer on that as well.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
So the presently the estate tax is at what level?
40%.
Okay, that's the level. And what's the lifetime exemption?
Currently 13.61%. And we have published numbers for 2025. That number jumps up to an inflation adjusted 13.99. Why they didn't push it to 14, we'll never know. But that's what they do back there, right, in that soup.
Okay. And so at that level, I would imagine, and you may know this, not a whole lot of estates are actually getting taxed. Am I right about that? And what happens if they don't? Will that get affected by the sunset provisions next year?
It does.
Okay. Where does it go back to?
It just roughly speaking, it looks like the projections are around 7 million.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So we'd wake up January 1st, 2026, and an individual would have a lifetime exclusion of let's say around 7 million, dropping from, of course, 14 million.
So I suppose the least appetizing strategy for tax minimization is to plan your death this year. But nonetheless,
now that's some tax planning.
but I think, given the sort of passion with which the estate tax has been labeled the death tax, you got to believe that there will be some movement on that one if they can get a bill through at all.
Yeah, the consensus now with a Trump presidency is, a year ago we thought the sunset was certain, mm-hmm. was locked in. Mm-hmm. And so as I discuss this topic with a lot of high net worth clients, the idea was in 2024, 2025, clients that were 30 million, 50 million, 100 million plus would be using up these extraordinarily high exemption amounts to transfer significant wealth to the next generation. Now, as a client looks at 2025, a lot of my clients are saying, you know what, I'm not so sure how much I want to transfer my wealth into an irrevocable design where I don't have any control. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my clients, that's already difficult to transfer wealth into a design where you don't have control. And now you add what may or may not happen. So, to give you a number, right? It's certain, it's sort of certain, we're 50-50 about the exclusion. Here's what's remarkable to me. The exclusion amount or the estate tax affects so few Americans. The question is, if Congress adds another sunset period, right? If they say, all right, let's keep the high exclusion, let's go ahead and let it sunset at the end of 2036. Politically speaking, that doesn't seem to poison the waters much. I don't know that your average voter really cares that much about a tax that affects, the very, very rich. It does have the optics of always favoring the rich, mm-hmm. right? So there's that side of it. But the thing that people say all the time is there are a lot of very wealthy politicians back in D.C., and there always has been some movement afoot in those back rooms to create a high exemption and to not introduce an exemption that goes back, right? Mm-hmm. That goes back. So I personally think another Q3, Q4 tax package that Ross talked about will be in place to extend those larger exemption or exclusion amounts.
So we're talking about the estate tax, which, as we've talked about, affects very few people. I want to turn to something that probably affects more people. And that's, we talked about the standard deduction being high and how it limits your ability to get a tax benefit from a charitable contribution. Let's talk about some strategies that people can use to try to beat that, to try to get that exemption. And one of which is this concept of trying to bundle contributions in a single year. Can you explain how that works?
Ross, I might have you talk about the income tax side of that. I might come back and talk about QCDs, donor advised funds.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's do the first one first. That makes a lot of sense. Straight, what I would call straight bundling. I want to have a big year where I give a lot so that I get over that standard deduction. Does that work?
Yes. That's a very permissible strategy. I think it's hard for a lot of people to kind of execute on because we don't think in multi-year cycles like that. But you can certainly load up your charitable contributions in 2024, get yourself, make your gifts for what you otherwise would have done in 2025, kick yourself over the standard deduction, get the marginal tax benefit of those deductions with, you know, the current federal tax rate of 37% plus your Utah state income tax rate, definitely adds a lot of juice to your giving money once you're, so to say, in the money.
And is that something that you have clients, is that something your clients do? Is that a strategy you see implemented by some of your clients?
I don't see a lot of it. I mean, I also am not preparing a lot of tax returns. Sure. and sort of in the weeds on that. I mean, I think a lot of our clients are probably much more interested in executing on the DAF strategy, the donor advised fund, which dovetails into that because it allows you to sort of take that group, that large deduction that you would do, you will do it in a particular year, but then going forward, you're allowed to advise the DAF on an annual basis about where it should direct your charitable contributions.
Yeah. So let's take a step backward. What is a DAF and how does it work? Where does the money sit? Can you just give us sort of DAF 101 before we jump right all the way in?
Yeah. A DAF is referred to as a donor advised fund. It is a pool of money that sits with a financial institution, and they functionally own the pool of money. They invest it, you know, alongside sort of somewhat advised investment directives. And then the original donor of the donor advised fund retains the right to advise the charity on where charitable contributions should be made on a year-by-year basis. So it's a little bit like what a lot of people refer to as an endowment, but it's much simpler. It has significantly less reporting. And, you know, you don't have to have hundreds or 200 or millions of dollars to set up a DAF. Lots of financial institutions will say, you know, even $20,000 to $25,000 as the initial corpus to establish a donor advised fund on behalf of an individual and allow them to direct the corpus from there.
And it's always an individual, right? The individual who creates the donor advised fund does not need a board. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep. And the donor advised fund strategy is can be used by both corporations and individuals. So if you're a company and you want to, you know, find a way to be more charitable, the donor advised fund is available to you as well, instead of going through the costly legal and accounting work of setting up a foundation or an endowment type structure. Which, you know, frankly, depending on how you do it or where you do it, it can mean a lot of money invested in people like Matt and myself and less money that goes to the charity to do it right.
We want to touch on qualified charitable distributions for how they can be used to contribute from an IRA or a 401k. Can you explain those?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you have a traditional IRA, when you reach, you know, whatever the minimum distribution age is, you're obligated to take income out of the IRA. And so that amount shows up as income on your tax return. And what was happening is that a lot of it, and there was a request and there was some legislation that was added and then it was enhanced lately with the SECURE Act, is that instead of taking that minimum distribution on your IRA as income, and then perhaps getting a charitable deduction, you know, sort of netting, you're allowed to just bypass your individual return and send your portion of your minimum distribution directly to those charities that you designate.
Gotcha. So therefore, you get the checks from the financial institution, and the checks are written out payable to the charity. So the tax, it just kind of, you're just the middleman who gets the mail and passes it on. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't even think you have to reroute it. The trustee of your IRA will typically just wire those funds directly. But what's nice on an income tax side is that the amount of that distribution is not even included in your income. So you don't have to go and search and figure out how does, then do I have a charitable deduction? It's just an off the top reduction in your gross income, and you know it's hitting the charity. And so it allows, you don't have to worry about the standard deduction.
Gotcha.
And the other unique feature of it is you don't have to wait till the RMD minimum age. You can do these distributions as soon as you turn 70 and a half. Sort of a little wrinkle in the way the code was written that allows people who are at that age to really leverage this to take advantage of it.
And what would be the advantage of that, just to reduce the size of the retirement account?
Yeah, if you wanted to be charitable or you otherwise have an income, but you can get ahead of the minimum distribution age if you want.
Gotcha. And that's every account that has the RMD requirement. So it's IRA, a 401k, an individual 401k, a simple IRA, and a SEP?
I think so. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, Matt, you were about to?
Well, I was going to maybe give you an example of how all this works together. Cool. So I have this discussion in my Park City practice all the time. let's say that you have Bill and Mary Jones. They've got an estate of let's say $30 million. And let's say of that $30 million, let's say $6 or $7 million of that is retirement money, right? So Bill and Mary Jones, they look at the lifetime exclusions. It's 14 and 14. They know they're just a little bit above threshold, and they want to start working on how to holistically plan their estate. So first things first. Once they hit RMD age, a lot of my clients in that economic realm would probably say, I don't need. In fact, I don't want that $100,000, $200,000 the government is going to require me to take out every single year. Mm-hmm. I have plenty of passive income. I have board income. I have other income. So the QCD is a perfect way to not take that income and redirect it to charities that couple would endorse or have endorsed for many, many, many years. Okay. The second issue from an estate tax standpoint is if your children inherit your retirement accounts under the Secure Act, your children have 10 years to withdraw all of that retirement money. And so as we begin to characterize the worst assets to inherit and the best assets to inherit under these exclusion amounts, there's a huge argument that retirement money, IRA money, SEP money, is the worst money on the planet to inherit because of ordinary tax rates, right? You might get dinged by the estate tax rate, and then you're forced to take it out over 10 years. And so sometimes what couples will do is they will transfer the balance of their IRAs when they die into their DAF. Another interesting way to be charitable with that tax-deferred money.
Good. We've been talking to Mac Minton and Ross Keel of the Parsons Bailey Firm. Thanks so much for giving us some wisdom. We'll be right back after this.
If you run a small or medium-sized manufacturing business, you may be looking for ways to trim the excess costs so you can hire more help. The IIAC may be able to help you do just that exact thing. Here to talk about what they do and who their ideal clients are Sam Protopapas and Julie Sieving. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Okay, so from I read some of the material. From what I've read, it seems that the IIAC program accepts grant applications from manufacturing businesses looking to save energy and reduce waste, thus save money. Is that the big picture?
Yes. In short, yes. You got it.
Okay. And Julie, first, how did you get started with the IIAC, and how long have you been there?
You bet. Yeah, that is a, that name is a alphabet soup mouthful for sure. So this is a University of Utah program. I personally have been with the program a little bit over 6 years prior to being in the energy consulting private sector.
Gotcha. And Sam?
I got started because I heard about it from some friends of mine. The program is actually through the chemical engineering department at the U, and I'm in the business school, so I didn't hear about it directly through my classes or however the other chemical engineers heard about it, but I had some friends involved, so they got me into it.
Okay, so you're a student at the U?
Yes.
And you're a professor at the U?
Correct.
Okay, we got that. So Julie's the professor, Sam is the student, and you both do this IIAC.
Okay, let's talk about somebody walks in the door. Talk me through how I guess the right word is client, interfaces with you. How does it start and how does the process work?
So it usually starts, someone from our outreach team or Julie will reach out to the client or they will reach out to us. And then we will have a brief sit-down meeting with them where we discuss any questions that they have and kind of go over the program. Then the next step is for them to send us energy bills, and then we'll go over their energy bills, make sure they're eligible and that we can try to help them. And then comes the site visit. So we'll go on site for about 8 hours, and most of that will be walking around the facility, assessing all of their machinery and energy consumption. And then we'll go to lunch and the team will talk, and then we'll come back to site and talk with the staff or operators, whoever's walking us around. We'll kind of bounce our ideas off of them and hear what they have to say. We're super interested in any ideas that they had coming into it, like areas that they already think they can save energy or areas that are giving them trouble. And then we'll take all of this information back to the U with us, do some analysis, and have a bunch of team meetings for a few weeks. And then we compile a big report and send it to the client.
Okay, and now is this just in Utah?
Utah is our main service area, but we actually serve a 5-state region.
Gotcha. And so does the grant recipient, once they get approved, do they receive money? Do they receive products, both consulting?
Yes, specifically the grant piece of it is actually some federal funding through the U.S. Department of Energy. So the process that Sam just described is the energy assessment process that's required as part of the application for the grant. By the way, I also just wanted to chime in on Sam's introduction there and add that there's an application for the program available through our program's website, which is energy.utah.edu.
Okay, so we go back to the U, we analyze it, we go, you got this totally inefficient boiler, you don't have any insulation, there's all these things you're doing that we could do better, right? So you make a list of recommendations, essentially?
Yes, in fact, specifically working with manufacturers, it typically comes down to 3 or 4 areas. We really look at their process equipment. So many, many manufacturers in the Utah region, as well as the Intermountain West, use compressed air systems. So we do a lot of recommendations around compressed air systems, as well as boilers, whether it's hot water, steam, or otherwise, perhaps motors and drives, as well as perhaps chiller systems or those kinds of things. And oftentimes we look for low-cost opportunities for them to be able to just do some tweaks, do some different programming to increase their efficiency. But if there are bigger opportunities around replacing equipment, we can also take a look at those opportunities.
And then that it's at that point you have a list of recommendations that somebody applies for a grant to help them pay for it. Have I got that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, how does that work? Go ahead.
So you can apply for the grant through the DOE website.
Yes.
Basically, the only eligibility requirement is that you've received an assessment from us, and that the money that you're applying for will go towards recommendations that we made. So that's why we really try to work with the client. Like if they have any ideas, any systems that they're wanting to replace, we will try to put that on our recommendation so that they can get federal money for that.
So something like a 40-year-old boiler.
Yes.
Exactly. And if it's going to cost me $50,000 to replace it, does the grant give me the full $50,000?
Actually, what DOE says is that they will fund projects up to $600,000 total. The project can actually exceed that amount, but DOE will consider up to $600,000. And what DOE asks the Department of Energy, that is that the company brings 50% of the funds to the table, and they will match that 50%.
So it's a matching program.
Yes, it's a matching program. The interesting thing, interesting wrinkle to that, as part of the 50% that the business is required to bring, they can bring other non-business funds. So if there's a utility rebate program associated with the replacement, that actually counts as part of the business's costs.
Oh.
And the DOE treats it all the same, 50-50. However, they bring their 50% is fair game.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So... we have a new administration coming in January 20th. You think the program's going to stick around?
Stick with us. We'll keep you posted. If you reach out to us through that website, energy.utah.edu, we'll keep you posted on the latest. And that is as best as I can say right now.
And give us a couple of classics. Are there any sort of publicly available, can you point us to some public available projects just so we can get a sense of some of the things that have actually happened?
Sure. Actually, let me say that part of our program's evaluation at the university by the, again, the Department of Energy is how much of what we recommend to our customers they actually implement. Mm-hmm. In these, what we call energy assessment programs that are run by utilities and other types of entities, it typically is somewhere between a 30 and 50% implementation rate. Our implementation rate is just over 50%, which means 50% of what we recommend to our customers, they implement. We actually had a customer just over the last 2 months qualify for the grant, and they were taking a look at, like I said, compressed air systems are very common. They actually also had a project where they wanted to do an overhead crane, which they felt like was going to increase their overall productivity, mm-hmm. and they also received funds for that.
Excellent. So real quick, last question, if you don't mind. I own a business. I'm busy. I am so busy. Is this an involved process, or I mean, do I need my CPA to do it, or can I like crank it out pretty quick?
No, it's not super involved. Basically, the only thing that we ask from you is that when we come on site, you have resources or people available to escort us around the facility, because we know that a lot of manufacturers are not comfortable with people just roaming the floor. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then there is, of course, the grant application process and the initial assessment application. But the initial assessment application takes probably 5 minutes, and we are totally willing to walk you through it. And then the grant application is, I think, a little more involved. Maybe Julie can speak more on this, but I don't think, again, I don't think it takes a very long time.
Gotcha. Well, we have to wrap this up. Thank you very much to Samantha Protopapas and Julie Sieving. Again, that website is energy.utah.edu, and they can find you both there with emails and phone numbers. Excellent. And we'll be right back in just a moment.
Our theme music was written by Parker Swenson and is performed by Swenson, David Becker, and Tony Ellison.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.